Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi, as you know, stands for Original Memorable Insights. Yes, that's OMI. From new books written by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hello, I'm Richard Ovenden, Director of the Bodleian Libraries in Oxford and the author of Burning the Books, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
The director of the world-famous Bodleian Library in Oxford reveals how knowledge has been attacked and preserved through the ages, telling us a great deal about culture, society, and civilization in every century, including our own.
And I think that's important for society to do, is to think in longer terms than just the immediate, because society benefits so much from understanding where it is now through looking at its past and looking at that journey that it's taken.
In Burning the Books, A History of Knowledge Under Attack, Richard Ovenden travels 4,000 years to the present day, from donkeys on clay tablets to donkeys leading parliament, an age of digital abundance where information storage and exploitation trumps knowledge preservation and truth, unless, of course, we are prepared to do something about it. Richard Ovenden, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to join you.
Now, you begin the book with one of the most powerful quotes regarding knowledge that I've ever come across, by the German poet Heinrich Heine: wherever they burn books, they will also in the end burn human beings. He wrote that in the 19th century, referring to Christian crusaders burning the Quran. Then his own books were burnt by the Nazis in 1933. Surely we've moved on from those dark days, Richard. The threat to archives and libraries is more financial than ideological today, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is financial, but it's also ideological. And my book is really partly an attempt to sort of look through history at the motivations for those who sought to destroy knowledge through the targeting libraries and archives, but also as a warning to the present day. So, you know, you can see both in Turkey, for example, today, you can see it in Yemen with the Zaidi community as having its libraries targeted. There are unfortunately numerous instances where knowledge is being attacked. And that is true in the physical environment as it is in the digital environment. And I think the digital brings a whole different aspect to the way that the preservation of knowledge and the security of open societies and democracy is being challenged by the way that we handle and manage information and knowledge.
I'll get onto digital in a minute because you've got a lot to say about it in the book. But looking back, the British are no strangers to the book burning practice, are they? Henry VIII in the Reformation, which led to people hiding collections.
Yep.
The British at the Library of Congress in Washington in 1814, you cover that. Why do people in power, or people seeking power, feel the need to destroy books? And on the other hand, why do some people, like Thomas Bodley, your figurehead, feel they're worth protecting so much, to the point where he disinherited his children to pay for your place of work where you are now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a fascinating issue of both sides of things. So I think those who sought to destroy knowledge, you know, sometimes this has been about ideological reasons. So it's about religion. So the Reformation was driven by religion. Religion in the past sort of is very, very difficult to disentangle from other motivations, whether they're political or cultural. So the religious destruction of books during the European Reformation of the 16th century was not just purely about doctrinal issues, not purely about faith. It was also about political power. And so, you know, Henry VIII, as I try to tell in that chapter in the book, was as much motivated by his own sort of political and dynastic aims to, but also a very personal one, you know, to divorce one wife and to marry a new one. And the justification for that became tied up with a much bigger on partly religious and partly, if you like, state and political issues about relinquishing the power of the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church on England, but also about securing the wealth tied up in the religious institutions, the monasteries and other religious institutions, which would enable him to gain more power. And you see that also in other parts of history. So the attack on the Library of Congress in Washington in 1814 was, you know, one state, Britain, attacking another and to really, you know, hit them where it hurt at the the seat of government, the Congress of the United States, relied on knowledge and information to be able to function. Burning its library and burning the building that Congress met in would, you know, stop them from being such an effective enemy. And you can see that again in a century later in Louvain, where one of the first episodes of World War One was the Germans entering neutral Belgium, occupying Louvain, and burning the university library down, which was not just a tool for the university, it was also a semi-national library. It had become a sort of a very, very important place for a relatively new kingdom. Belgium had only been in existence for less than a century, and it had cultural treasures. It was a library of legal deposit. It held important manuscripts about the history of their own country and their own institution. And burning it down became an international notorious act, echoing the destruction or the myth of the destruction of the Library of Alexandria in antiquity. There are religious reasons. There's one state arguing against another. It's part of those kind of political campaigns, but it's also about sort of culture as well. And, you know, we see that, we saw that in the Holocaust, where, you know, a whole culture was attempted to be eradicated, not just obviously the records of their existence, but the human beings themselves, tragically. And we saw that again in the Balkan conflicts of the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia, where the Serbs tried to not just to occupy Bosnia, but to eradicate through the destruction of provincial archives and landholding records any sense that Muslims had ever owned property in Bosnia. There are a whole kind of mixture of reasons, and some of which are held at that, as it were, concurrently.
And it seems that book burning, attacking knowledge, is a way to try and rewrite or reposition, reframe the past in order to control the present. And I might be stretching it a little bit now, the analogy, but I couldn't help but thinking Henry VIII's harking back to Arthurian legend and days of yore to put his case for divorcing Catherine of Aragon and Marie Anne Boleyn isn't a million miles away from the way Nigel Farage longs for ye olde England to get his way divorcing us from Europe. Is that a fair comparison?
I'd say there are echoes of that. I do see echoes of that. I mean, you know, sort of more broadly, what Henry was trying to do was to say, well, you know, there was an English church in the Anglo-Saxon period before the Norman conquest and the, if you like, bringing of overseas influence. And of course, his search for those documents ignored the fact that actually there were these incredibly powerful cultural ties in Europe at the time that meant it was not only a rewriting of history, but a falsifying of history to make those claims. And one of the books that I highlight that is preserved from the Reformation, St. Dunstan's class book, one of the great Anglo-Saxon saints and Archbishop of Canterbury, and one of his books survives here in the Bodleian Library. And it was actually formed from documents that he collected from his European contacts. So there were these European intellectual and religious interplays between Anglo-Saxon England and continental Europe that were very vibrant and very lively, which Henry just tried to kind of ignore, as it were, for his own political aims.
As someone who now presides over possibly the greatest collection of books and artifacts in the world, if not one of them, you didn't grow up surrounded by books in your house, did you? But you did spend a lot of time in your local library in Deal. Who were your role models then? The only one I can think of at the time in the, say, 60s and 70s is Philip Larkin. Who did you look up to?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I was lucky in having, you know, my parents didn't have a lot of books. They didn't have a lot of money to buy books. But they valued education. And we were lucky to have, obviously, a public library in the town I grew up in. And my mother took me there as a small child and borrowed children's books. And then when I was a teenager, I went in by myself and just browsed the shelves and found things for myself. And it opened up new worlds for me, not just in terms of kind of reading of fiction, but that was really important for me, but also of, you know, helping me do my schoolwork, to, you know, write my essays. But also I found, you know, you could borrow vinyl records in Deal Public Library, and that opened up another, a whole nother world for me. I don't necessarily think I had role models then, but I certainly had authors who I was passionately devoted to. So J.R.R. Tolkien helped me become a deep reader, but also a book collector. So, you know, he wrote a lot. So I wanted to have all his books, and I wanted to have books about him. I bought Humphrey Carpenter's biography. I bought the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. I went to bookshops. And so, but I was also able to borrow them from the public library. And the same is true of kind of, you know, typical teenage boy, science fiction, Brian Aldiss, Isaac Asimov. So it was really those authors. But in terms of libraries, it was my university. I went to Durham University and really encountered a big library, a big, impressive library with lots and lots of different aspects to it. And I was lucky enough to meet librarians there. Beth Rainey, who was my first boss as a librarian, was an incredibly inspiring individual. And she really opened up the importance of the preservation, but also how interesting preserving, managing, and making knowledge available could be. And I owe them a huge amount. All the libraries I've worked in, all the bosses I've had have been brilliant in different ways.
I visited your office at the Bodleian Library, which is a real pleasure and a privilege. And the thing that sticks in my mind is how comfortable and at ease you were in the middle of all that knowledge. I've studied there too, and I always felt a great weight around me of knowledge. Don't you ever feel that burden of history upon you to look after everything, to keep collecting, to keep preserving? Yes. It's quite overwhelming to visitors. So God knows what it must be like for you. Do you feel that pressure?
I do feel the pressure. I do feel the pressure. It does wake me up in the middle of the night sometimes, as it does many of my colleagues as well. I mean, we're all, on the one hand, incredibly fortunate, and we count our blessings that we work here. We've got fantastic collections. We've got amazing buildings. We've got wonderful readers. The academic community in the university is superb, but also the readers who come from all over the world to use our collection. But at the same time, the burden of responsibility is huge. Our predecessors, I'm the 25th librarian here, my 24 predecessors and the predecessors going back into the Middle Ages before them, managed to keep that knowledge alive, managed to preserve it and to pass it on to their successors. And we all here in the Bodleian feel the weight of that responsibility, and we take it very, very seriously. And it's our job not only to put the measures in place and to keep alert and to monitor things and to keep it safe, but also to advocate for it, to argue for more funding, to, you know, to make people aware of what a great jewel it is, just as our counterparts in other libraries around the world have that task too.
And you don't just preserve books at the Bodleian. I mean, for many years, you've been preserving artifacts, maps, objects, and we have so much new knowledge at our fingertips now. Is the written word on the page, in your opinion, still the best way to transfer knowledge and generate insights now, forever, through the ages? Will it ever change?
Well, it is already changing. It has already changed. So I come from the rare books and manuscripts community. So I love the printed page or the written document, you know, and I've just published a book in physical format. So they've still got a very, very important part to play in, you know, communicating ideas. And I think they will have long, you know, into the future, if not forever. But at the same time, knowledge is changing its format. It's becoming increasingly digital. Now, we're doing this interview using digital technology. I've just spent the morning sending emails. I've been looking at websites. All of this knowledge is all around us. It pervades almost every aspect of our life. And I think libraries and archives have to engage with that world. We are engaging with it. Here in the Bodleian, we had our first website in the 1990s. We did our first mass digitization in that same decade. And we've been building on that ever since, as most libraries around the world have been doing the same. As a community, a practice, we're also now very, very concerned about how to preserve that knowledge into the future, not just for continuing, if you like, the research enterprise, but also the broader sense of communication and knowledge creation in society as a whole. So, you know, the use of social media, the use of the web, of blogs, text messaging, all sorts of private forms of communication. If we're able to continue to perform our role, we have to be capturing knowledge in those forms and to make it available today and into the future. And it's a big challenge, but we're very, very committed to it across the globe in the library and archive community.
And Richard Ovenden, you're a librarian of great standing. Yes, I am going to say you are a rock star librarian.
Oh, you've got, I don't know about that.
you've got
you
some amazing.
Yeah,
well, there's technology that can take care of that. But the collections you have, I mean, you've got Shakespeare's First Folio in there, Mary Shelley's manuscript. You've got amazing things. It's just a treasure trove, like you say, and you've published a book with full of those artifacts. What about the lesser known librarians, the people in the towns and the cities around the country, around the world, who are having their libraries closed? What part are they playing in the preservation of knowledge, and what can we do to help them, and how can they change, you know, in the way that you've been able to change, because you've got an amazing foundation and you are on top of change as it's happening?
Well, I think that's a very big question, Richard. I think there are several things that we can do, and people like me who are fortunate to be in very kind of high profile institutions, and that's to advocate for libraries more generally. So, and that's what I try to do in my book and through all my involvement in professional organizations, trying to advocate for the role of libraries and archives in cross society, across the globe, in a very general way, to argue for more funding, to argue for their parent institutions to take them very seriously, and to argue for society as a whole to treasure them. But also, there are ways in which we can support each other through professional organizations, like I'm proud to be a member of the Research Libraries UK, which is the body which supports the research library community of SCONAHL, the Standing Conference on National University Libraries. I'm a member of the Chartered Institute of Library and Information Professionals, which are a professional body. I'm speaking at their annual conference this year. I'm on the board of the Council on Library and Information Resources in the US. So there is a professional community that supports each other, but I think we have to get the word out. We have to be visible in the public domain. And that's partly why I wrote this book, to raise the awareness of the value of preserving knowledge through the institution of libraries and archives more generally, and to use whatever channels, whether it's the Bookomi podcast or articles that I've written in national newspapers or blogging that I do. It's not about the Bodleian alone. I'm obviously immensely proud of our institution, but the community of libraries and archives as a whole is what I'm really concerned about.
You share a publisher, John Murray, with Lord Byron, and ironically, Byron's memoirs, which would have been a bestseller to this day, were destroyed by John Murray II and his mates after the poet's death in 1824, which you cover in the book. Why did he do that? And can you forgive him for that now?
I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure for forgiveness is really kind of relevant at this stage. I regret that he did it. I'm sure it would have been a sensational read, but I can understand the motivation. And I think his descendants, his family, and those who he was very close to, like John Murray, were very concerned about his reputation. I mean, he was famously, you know, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And so that his own kind of notoriety, which made him sell a lot of books in his lifetime, would have made undoubtedly his memoirs a bestseller, but his loved ones, his friends, were concerned that it would ruin his reputation for all time. Now, whether or not that would have been true, we can't tell, but I can certainly understand the motivation. Obviously, as a librarian and, you know, in this institution, as you said, we have fantastic romantic archives, the Shelley family in particular. Society is better for having those documents survive. We're enriched by Shelley's poetry. We're enriched by Mary Shelley's stories like Frankenstein, which we have the manuscript of as one of our greatest treasures. And we're lucky that, you know, other writers have either pulled themselves back from the brink, or have their descendants have decided to disobey them, like Max Brod and Franz Kafka's archive. So Max Brod, disobeyed the instructions that Kafka left him to destroy his papers. And that's why we have a much richer set of works from that great writer, who's regarded as the greatest writer in the German language of the 20th century by many. And we're lucky to have a significant part of his archive here in the Bodleian. And the world is a better place for having Kafka's writing survive. So, my urge is always towards preservation.
I think that was very diplomatically put. You met him now. If you met him now, or if you could go back in time, you'd probably stop that happening, wouldn't you?
If I was in the room in 50 Albemarle Street, I would have urged it to be preserved, locked away in a safe, and made available long after the death of everyone who would have been personally affected by it. So, there are these techniques that you can use that doesn't actually knowledge actually to be destroyed. And in institutions like mine, and I think this is another aspect, important aspect of libraries and archives, is that we tend to be enduring institutions unless we're deliberately destroyed. Many, many libraries and archives have long histories, and we think in longer term. And I think that's important for society to do, is to think in longer terms than just the immediate, because society benefits so much from understanding where it is now through looking at its past and looking at that journey that it's taken. And it helps us face the future.
Can we talk about curation for a second? I was surprised to read how much knowledge libraries destroy as part of the curating process. Rather naively, I thought, and I've thought this for a long time, that you kept everything forever. How do you decide what to take down to the skip?
Well, that's relatively easy one there. We have our policies, we have collection development policies, most institutions like mine, and certainly in my institution, our aim is not to destroy, if you like, the last copy. So, we might acquire 30 or 40 copies of a particular textbook that are needed for an undergraduate course. And when that textbook becomes unnecessary, or it's superseded by a new edition, or the course has changed, we don't need to keep 30 or 40 copies of it, but we do need to keep at least one copy. And that is what we will do. So that knowledge is not destroyed. It's just that multiplication of it is not necessary. And the library sector as a whole has become better at organizing itself so that there are, and we use a concept in the digital world now called LOCKS, and the acronym is Lots of Copies Keep Stuff Safe. So the fact that we're able, as a kind of, if you like, an international network to preserve knowledge, is also part of the tools that, if you like, the curatorial tools we're able to deploy. But in the archive world, you cannot keep every single piece of paper or every single digital file. It's just not affordable. So there are techniques like sampling, there are retention and disposal schedules that are used so that the most important knowledge is kept. And whether that's for legal or evidential reasons or for long-term historical value, that's the skill of librarians and archivists, to make sure that that knowledge is preserved, that we're not destroying the last bit of any vital piece of information, that we're either keeping it here or we know that there's another institution which has a commitment to its preservation.
With relatively recent episodes, like the Windrush scandal, which inspired the writing of the book, you highlight how the poor preservation of archives leads to injustice. The truth itself is under attack, you say. In our times, how do you think we can improve our access to truth? Isn't the internet the universal library of now, the Alexandria of now?
Well, it is, but it's very fragile. As a library, it is not a permanent record. The great search engines, the great social media companies are not preserving institutions. They're here to make money, and they're here to make money, the present and the immediate future. And what, as libraries and archives, can do to help ensure an open and plural society, to help preserve democracy, is to preserve the internet and the social media interactions that we have and that politicians make, for example, so that they can be held to account, so that those statements can be used to show how politicians or other leaders have either changed their views or that they've gone back on their promises. And I think that's an important part of an open society. And when the web or social media or digital communications are changing so fast and they're so fragile, as the work that my colleagues in the Legal Deposit Libraries do with web archiving, or the Digital Preservation Coalition is very, very concerned about, we can use techniques to preserve the web and to preserve social media. Our challenge is not the technological one, it's a funding challenge. And that's why I've introduced, or trying to suggest, this concept of a memory tax on the big tech companies, so that libraries and archives can really fulfill their role as institutions that cling to the truth, to borrow a phrase from George Orwell.
Very interesting. And you say we're becoming complacent. That's the danger, is becoming complacent, that we're allowing all our digital abundance to be controlled more and more by fewer private companies.
Absolutely. And we don't know, there's so much of that digital interaction, it happens invisibly. So all the interactions we make, like clicking like on Twitter or Facebook, or the searching that we do on the big search engines like Google, all of that information, our digital profiles, are sold on a daily basis. They're traded by the big tech companies, and they're also then used, as we have become more recently to understand, for example, for targeted political advertising in order to interfere in elections. And so if we're able to preserve that data, which I, you know, really libraries and archives aren't able to grapple with at the moment, but I think we'll be able to better serve society, I think, and to make society more open and our political system more open.
And what about the content that's like recorded on YouTube or TikTok? How in hell do you get your head around preserving any of that? Or is that just ephemeral and disposable? I mean, lots on YouTube is historical documentation. And you cite one of the examples where they destroyed a lot of videos that would historically be important for our understanding of Syria and the Middle East.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, YouTube is not an archive. It's a platform for publishing, in essence. And so that's where the job of libraries and archives come, is to, you know, use the skills of curation in order to select material that is needed for long-term preservation. And it's become much more difficult to do because of the multiplicity of platforms, the multiplicity of technologies, all the legal and copyright and information regulation around that. But we're not shying away from the challenge. And so many libraries and archives have web archiving programs, we have digital archiving programs, but we're trying to work in a very financially challenged situation. And that's where, you know, we need more support. We need society, we need governments, we need funding bodies to give us more support to be able to perform these tasks.
You conclude the book with a summary of 5 functions of libraries and archives and the role they play in our future. The listener will have to get a copy of your book for all 5, but which one of those 5 functions would you say is the most important to society at large?
I don't think I'm not going to...
I'm putting you on the spot there a little bit, aren't I?
Yeah. One. You're putting me on the spot. That's why there are 5 and there isn't one. I think it's important to be aware. I think the most urgent of the issues is the one that we've just been discussing, Richard, which is about digital preservation and digital archiving for the sake of open society and for open democracies. And that's a critical one that we have now. But the others, education, you know, integrity in decision making, cultural identity, you know, these are all equally important and crucial things that libraries and archives perform for society, and we need to recognize and value those.
Thomas Jefferson compared the spread of knowledge to the way a candle is lit from one to another. Richard Irvenden, thanks for lighting the way today by sharing your OMI with Bokomi.
Thank you, Richard. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Richard Irvenden's book, Burning the Books, A History of Knowledge Under Attack, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bokomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bokomi, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe. And remember, books are people in print. Treat them with respect.